Do you like books? I mean, really, really like books? Then you're in the right place. Each week, your host, Sam Hankin, interviews the best of today's top-selling authors and the up-and-coming superstars of modern literature. This is The Avid Reader. Here is your host, Sam Hankin.
Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to another edition of The Avid Reader. Today, our guest is Mona Awad, author of Bunny, published just June 11th by Viking. Mona is also author of the acclaimed 13 Ways of Looking at a Fat Girl. Her writing has appeared in Time, Vice, Electric Literature, McSweeney's, the LA Times, and lots of other publications. So anyway, Bunny gives us the story of Samantha, a student at a prestigious university where she's a graduate seeking her MFA. From that point on, though, things begin to go awry, to say the least. Samantha begins to abandon her closest friend as if she is drawn magnetically, well, she is, to a group of fellow students named Bunnies. Bunnies because they call themselves that. These Bunnies have been described as twee by about 100 publications. They are that, sugary, sweet, treacly, fawning, and any other adjective you can come up with which describes a bunch of women who, while adults, act somewhat like cliquey cheerleaders at a posh boarding school. But behind their glittering and My Little Pony exteriors lurks a horror that evolves in a real and perhaps slightly less real way that forces the reader delightedly to read on, generally in one sitting. And although I am a 67-year-old white male that would probably sidle away from this work in my bookstore, I find myself as entranced as others will, notwithstanding the, you know, sorry, perhaps chick lit title and the premise of the book. So the climax and the denouement of Bunny is something I can't talk about here, but trust me, you'll be aghast, delighted, perhaps a bit confused in a good way when you close the book hoping for more. But, dear reader, there will be more as Bunny has been picked up by AMC as a TV series, and which Mona will be able to flesh out as a screenwriter some of the twists and turns of this remarkable work. So with that, welcome, Mona, and thanks so much for joining us today.
Oh, thank you. Thank you very much for having me.
So, where do these bunnies come from, and where is their warren?
The bunnies are Samantha's, they're her peers in her class, And they've kind of, as you've described, they've sort of formed a clique, and she's very much on the outside. And Warren University is an Ivy League school in New England, and it's of course completely fictional, but it is certainly drawn from my own experience doing a graduate work at Brown and doing specifically an MFA at Brown. And then, as well, I have to say, doing a PhD in creative writing at the University of Denver, which is a totally different, climate and school, but still definitely informed kind of my approach to depicting art school life.
Yeah, so I was going to ask that before you told me actually about your MFA and whether this was where it started or not. So, taking off from there. Did any of the characters, as one woman or as like part of a cohort, inform you as you began this process? So was there one person or multiple people that you drew upon?
Yeah, I would say probably, all the characters are, of course, totally fictional, but there were definitely dynamics that I observed, in art school that I wanted to kind of capture in this book. There's no question about that, because art school breeds really strange dynamics. You know, you get very, very intimate very quickly with people because you're sharing your work with each other, and because it's creative work, it kind of feels like you're sharing your soul. And so people connect very, very deeply and very, very quickly with each other. And they're also very vulnerable with each other, in a secluded kind of insular place, and for a couple of years, sometimes even 3 years. So those climates breed strange relationships, and those relationships were definitely what I wanted to explore in Bunny.
Hey, so do you think I'm sure you've been amazed and delighted by all the blurbs and now the soon-to-be cinematic rendering of this tale, right? I mean, obviously.
Yeah, no, absolutely.
So do you think, and this is like a bunny question, do you think that any of your past colleagues, if you will, or fellow students, or your peers, do you think any of them are like jealous of your success, both in your last book and in this one?
I don't know. I mean, I think, you know, a lot of my colleagues have done, you know, really great things with their work, and, you know, have made work that I've just deeply admired. And what's interesting about art school too, I have to say, and which Bunny kind of explores a little bit, but not really this so much, is that everybody kind of goes in at a different place in their life, and at a different place with their work. And so, you know, my colleagues really ranged. You know, some people came in with really no idea of what their major project was going to be, and they went there to kind of figure that out and to figure out what they were going to work on, what they were going to do that was big, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And some people came in with a project that was in draft form that they wanted to just have the time to really get into and really deeply revise. Some people were older, some people were younger. So I think it kind of depends on where you are in your career, how you're going to kind of feel about, you know, your fellow colleagues. To say that there's no competition in those environments would be a total lie, because there absolutely is. And, you know, sometimes I guess it can be a little bit overt. But I've been very fortunate in that I've had very supportive colleagues. I mean, without my colleagues, I would have never finished 13 Ways of Looking at a Fat Girl, which was my first book, and that's what I went to Brown to actually finish. And I finished it there. That was my MFA thesis. And then for Bunny, I actually wrote as a PhD student at the University of Denver.
Wow.
And I had really great colleagues there who really helped me and who were very supportive of the project and who thought it was funny, you know, even though I was kind of taking the piss at a lot of the things that we were a part of. They enjoyed that because it is funny, you know. We're in school, but we're adults. It's funny. It's bound to be funny. And you find yourself behaving in kind of, you know, high school-like ways. You can't help it because you're in school.
Yeah, I know, and that was the thing that first got to me, was when someone said, either Samantha or someone else said, I'm 25 years old, and I thought, oh, wow, they're 25.
Yeah.
They've graduated college, they're in this program, and yet this is the way they act, which is really, you know, the way we are when we're kids is the way we end up being when we're old. I know from experience.
Yeah, I mean, that's kind of what I guess I was finding, too, was that, you know, even as an adult, I couldn't help but witness, like, this, I mean, and this is true, I think, no matter what age you're at, that there are these, that there is a great potential for cliques. and whenever there's that potential, there's also the potential to experience alienation and outsiderness and all of that. And, you know, in school, that gets magnified by like 100, because you're in an insular environment. So you feel it even more keenly. You know, you feel intimate with people more keenly, and you also feel, if you're outside, you feel that outsiderness more keenly.
You know, it's funny. This is totally off the wall. I just thought of this. But I've interviewed like 20 people whose agent is Bill Clegg. And I interviewed Bill Clegg, Did You Ever
Right.
Have a Family? And, you know, a little bit about his previous book. And it's amazing how I'm drawn to those books. And also, the last one I interviewed said he must have more than 24 hours in every day, because they don't know how he does it. And you thank him in your acknowledgments. But isn't he an amazing guy?
Yes, he's so amazing. I mean, yeah, Bill believing in this book is what made this book possible completely. I mean, his notes were so inspiring. You know, he helped me find it. He helped me find the finished book. And it was totally exciting to work with him, and he's such a great reader. Just, he's got such a great imagination, too. I adore him. I think he's wonderful, and he's so supportive.
Yeah, yeah. And his website is so nice. It's so simple. Well, anyway, that's
enough. Yeah, and he's a great writer, too.
He's
a great writer.
And what he came from, you know, and the depths he was in to, I don't anyway, that's enough about him. We're trying to sell your book. Okay.
Right.
All right. So I was going to think this was a spoiler, but since all the reviews mention it, basically, you know, Arthur C. Clarke said any sufficiently advanced technology is indistinguishable from magic. But that's not the kind of magic we have here, because it's, well, perhaps it's not technological. What do you consider, what did you consider, and now what do you consider magic to be?
Well, for me, I'm operating from kind of an obsession with fairy tales that I've had ever since I was a child. And I actually, studied fairy tales in school, too. I went and I did a master's and just studying fear in the fairy tale specifically, because that was what was so exciting to me about fairy tales. There's so much anxiety. They're palpable. You know, the anxiety is so palpable in a fairy tale, just as much as the wonder and the magic, you know. And what's so interesting to me about fairy tale magic is that it's not explained, and that is what makes it magical, is the fact that it's just there in the world. And so I wanted the magic in Bunny to kind of operate in that way. I wanted it to operate sort of intuitively, and I wanted the book to follow a kind of dream logic that fairy tales follow. And I wanted the magic to just, you know, be present but not explained, and as a result have kind of the power that magic that I think, you know, magic that is unexplained has. So I was very, very careful when I was writing the book, kind of not to dissect anything too much. I wanted it to be mysterious, you know, some of the transformations that occur, and I don't want to give anything away, but I didn't want to explain those or draw those out too finely.
It's funny, isn't it, how, like, if you look at Grimm's fairy tales, how for the modern age everything's expurgated, because the fairy tales are incredibly scary and would traumatize, put some kid on Prozac or Ativan or something like that.
Yeah, and it's like it's the multiple anxieties in there, you know. It's sort of the adult anxieties, you know, around their own children. But then it's also the adult's projection of what the child might be fearing. So it's those two anxieties together, sort of like nesting, and then, you know, all the other things going on too, just the social or cultural context of the story and whatever collective fears might be, you know, explored in the story. There's all of those different threads of fear going on. And so the result is just an extremely powerful tale that, yeah, has a kind of primal fear at the heart of it. And I've always found that so compelling. And so Bunny weaves a few different fairy tales, you know, into its narrative that I love, you know, like Beauty and the Beast and like Cinderella, like Little Red Riding Hood a little bit. And there's also actually a fairy tale with a rabbit for a bridegroom. It's called The Hare's Bride. It's incredibly sad. But it is also very menacing, too.
Yeah, it's funny. I wanted to say something about Red Riding Hood, but that would be a big spoiler, so I'm not going to.
Yeah, no, that is true. But it's a great story. I love that fairy tale so much. And all of the variants of it are so dark. I mean, some are incredibly dark, but there's a version where I think it's Italian. It's the Italian version where, you know, Little Red Riding Hood is tricked into drinking her grandmother's blood and eating her flesh. It's just horrible.
Yeah,
but
that wouldn't work.
Yeah.
That's not a Disney kind of card.
No, that wouldn't make it to the screen. Disney was in charge.
Well, you know, speaking of your youth and your fascination with this, and I'm not saying to compare this, although there might be some element. You know, throughout the book, in italics, Samantha's mother, and again, not to give away anything, is there in the background of your mind and her mind, and is constantly, especially the way you have her arms out, looking up and saying the things she says. Was any of that part of your childhood? Because was it?
I mean, I love to make up stories, which is something that I have in common with Samantha. And, you know, one of my first audiences was definitely my mother. So I would test things out on her for sure. And I enjoyed embellishing things. And, you know, I was also afraid of everything. And I have that in common with Samantha, too. So, you know, I would just come up with a reason to be afraid of something. And my imagination would always just go so far into the dark. And I think that definitely freaked both my parents out. But, you know, the fact that I could make an impression on, like, either of them with these stories definitely must have got me kind of going, that I knew I could kind of captivate an audience, even though that audience was just, you know, my mother or my father. But, I mean, I have always loved to tell stories. And I've always loved to read too, and my mother was definitely a big part of the reading too, because she loved to read as well. And my father maybe less so, but my mother definitely. There were always books around the house.
Did you do that stuff at night in your room, like the closet door and under the bed and all that stuff?
Yeah, I did. And I also I love to write dialogues a lot. That would really entertain me. And then I would go with my mother to work, because she was a waitress, and then for a while she was a restaurant manager, and she would kind of let me sit in the booth in the back of the restaurant and try to keep me busy with something. And they had these paper placemats, so I would write stories on the backs of those very often.
That's echoed a little bit in the book. Okay.
Yeah, that childhood of kind of busying yourself with storytelling, that's something that, you know, was definitely something I had and that I did. I loved to entertain myself with stories. And sometimes books wouldn't cut it, you know, I would need to figure it out on my own. That became very exciting, the idea that you could make your own characters and make your own narratives, and that anything was possible on that piece of paper.
Yeah, and that's exactly what we were talking about earlier before we started, about the unreliable narrator. I mean, who's to say whether something is subjective to an individual or objectively realized in the real universe? And, you know, no one can do that, and that's part of it. I'll just say it that way.
Yeah, no, it is. I mean, playing with perspective is something this book really leans into. You know, that's something that, you know, the part of where the magic even comes from is the fact that, you know, this is someone's subjective reality, and just leaning into that as much as possible. You know, this is a story being told through the eyes of someone whose imagination is really overactive, who's feeling very raw and who's feeling very vulnerable. And all of those things are coloring the way she's seeing people, the way she's seeing herself, the way she's seeing the world. So how sinister it actually is, you know, kind of, you know, open to interpretation. It really is.
Yeah. And also animals, stags, swans, bunnies.
Yeah, there are animals in that world.
It is.
Yeah. And that's the fairy tale piece for sure. You know, not to give anything away, but I love the way animals function in fairy tales. And I love their kinship with us and their relationship with us and their ability to transform. And, you know, and that's, to me, that there's a real parallel between that act of transformation in fairy tale from animal to man, or from, you know, from man to animal or woman to animal, to creative work, you know, because it kind of follows the same inexplicable laws, you know, and is mysterious and is, you know, it is a transformation. And so I really wanted to play with that in Bunny.
Yeah, and it's funny because when the stag is involved, that is somewhat Disney-esque, you know, like with Bambi and, you know, the fact that there's
this
grand male deer, and then poor Bambi's mom gets killed, which, you know, was traumatic to me as a kid, you know.
Me too.
That was horrible. Was horrible for a lot of kids. That was their first, many kids' introduction to what happens for real in the world, what happens to everybody.
Yeah.
Well, anyway, so here. So, okay, we got bunnies. They call each other Bunny. And rather than me recite it, why don't you tell us the names of the four of them and give us a little bit of their characteristics, because I think that's okay if we do that.
Sure. Yeah. Okay. So the first one is Cupcake, she looks also like a cupcake. She wears those kinds of fit and flare dresses, you know, and she has a little golden bob, and she writes these post-feminist dialogues between herself and various kitchen implements. And she's kind of, I would say, in terms of her ranking, because there are real power struggles going on between the four girls. There's definitely dominant bunnies, and there are kind of more subservient bunnies. And there are tensions between these four that are very subtle, but they're there. And I would say that Cupcake, in terms of her ranking, is maybe like she's like second highest. She's like just beneath, you know, the Duchess, who I would say is the absolute ruler of the bunnies. And the Duchess is a highly experimental writer, and this is kind of one of her defining characteristics. She writes with a diamond, actually, and etches her prose, her proems, actually. They're proems. They're half prose, half poetry. She writes this kind of experimental verse that quotes heavily from theorists and stuff, and she is very enigmatic, and she is somebody that Samantha is very intimidated by. She's also very beautiful in a kind of eerie fairy tale way. She has long silver hair. And then there's Vignette. Vignette is kind of the punk bunny. And she's also very experimental, but in a more gritty way, much less ethereal than the Duchess. She likes to wear her combat boots, although she does wear a baby doll dress. And she sort of speaks in monosyllables. That was one of the things that I kept reminding myself when I was writing her, is that she doesn't say much. You know, she's kind of like just always observing, kind of with a half smile, half frown on her face. So she's very sly and kind of brash and thrills in that. And then finally, there's Creepy Doll. And Creepy Doll she looks just as she's described. She looks like a creepy doll. She's very, very beautiful, but kind of in an eerie way. And she is sort of like the Little Red Riding Hood type character. She's a fan of fairy tale. She's a fan of myth, and she's the nicest probably to Samantha, and I would also say she's the most subservient of the bunnies. She's kind of because she's so nice, and I think because also she's very, very pretty. They've turned her into kind of their pet. You know, so she's sort of the pet of the bunnies. And I think that Creepy Doll, maybe she resents this a little bit, and it comes out at certain moments in the book.
Yeah, and that's very true towards a certain part of the book. So let me ask you a question. This may be very painful for me. I don't know yet. But I love Kate Bush and Wuthering Heights, and I also love Roxy Music and Slave to Love. Does that mean I'm twee?
No, not at all. I love Kate Bush, and I love that song, Wuthering Heights, and I also love Roxy Music, and I love Brian Ferry, and I love Slave to Love. No, I think the bunnies are, you know, that those songs play at the bunnies' prom, where something very violent occurs, violent and magical occurs, and Samantha, you know, is present, and she is, I mean, we could say that she's, you know, the victim of this scene. And this music is playing. I think it's very fitting because both songs, to me, they're so beautiful, but they both, when juxtaposed with kind of the horrific kind of atmosphere of the prom, but also, you know, the kind of romantic implications of the prom and all of the sort of adolescent dreams around prom, I just felt like it was the perfect contrast, you know?
Yeah.
It felt perfect.
That gives me
because the bunnies themselves kind of walk that edge. Yeah, they are twee, but they're also very sinister. You know, they're that sweet, monstrous kind of paradox. And to me, sweet things can be monstrous. You know, they often are because they're so powerful. They're so seductive. You almost feel like you have no will when you're confronted with something that's adorable, you know. You just have to, you know, bow down to it, you know, succumb to it. And I wanted to kind of lean into the horror of sweetness.
Well, that's like 80% relief for me. But when they were like when they were playing Wuthering Heights over and over and over again, then I got
that can get serious.
So we're talking about, you know, this idea of, you know, horror mixed with this incredible sweetness and those lovely dresses with all kinds of cute little things on them. Do you like when your book is compared, and you do it too, kind of, like to Carrie or to Heather's or The Craft, because there's been so many comparisons? How do you feel about that?
I mean, I think that they're appropriate, you know, because I was thinking of those things when I was writing, and that was definitely half maybe not half, but like a third of the mix was exactly that kind of culty teen movie, sometimes horrific, sometimes like, you know, more kind of campy like Heather's. And I don't know if The Craft is really campy, but it's great. I loved it when I first saw it as a teenager. I thought it was so much fun. And I love the fact that those films play with what it's like to be an outsider. They play with the cruelty of cliques, you know, and so those films were in my head alongside kind of, you know, the idea of fairy tale magic and also just, you know, the world of art school, which is its own weird beast, you know. So I think that the book kind of does follow some of the tropes of those films. So it to me it's great. You know, people are catching on to something that I was thinking about.
You know, following up on that, there's lots of references in the book to popular culture, like Sissy Spacek, Jane Eyre, The Waves, Sid Vicious, The Bachelor, Christian
yeah.
Slater, and then Serious Moonlight. Pixie Sticks.
Right.
I mean, there's a lot of stuff in there that some, you know, I mean, it's pretty much where we are in a lot of ways. And especially when you're talking about Christian Slater and you think of the movies he's been in and stuff like that, or The Bachelor, which is silly. But
right.
Why'd you decide to do that? Or did it just, I don't know, why did you?
I love popular culture. I mean, I love playing around with it and, you know, having fun putting it in more kind of subversive sort of context, like in this story, and sort of playing with how it shaped us, you know, and our relationship to it, and the bunny's relationship to it versus Samantha's relationship to it, you know. It's just so much fun to play around with. And it really felt like the book, because the book in part, because it's called Bunny and because it's kind of playing with this like adorable little emblem, it's part of that kind of exploring sweetness, you know, exploring cuteness and teasing out kind of the monstrousness or the more sinister aspects of that.
Yeah, it's kind of like, it's not exactly like this, but it's like when the witch and the gingerbread house, and at first you think, well, yeah, she's just a nice old lady. And
right.
And then I was thinking, okay, is Samantha a nice person? Are any of the bunnies nice people? So then I kind of jumped to the two characters that really aren't part of the circle, which is Ava and Jonah. And both of them
right.
seem like good people deep
yeah.
down in their own ways.
Yeah.
But are they the only ones that are good? Would you say that?
Yeah. I don't know. I mean, I think there's an argument to be made, yeah, that they are the only ones that are good. But I think that part of the reason why the bunnies are the way they are, again, is because we're seeing everything through Samantha's eyes, which are eyes you can't really trust. And so how good they are outside the context of this school is something you could argue. You know, can we really trust Samantha to, like, accurately depict these women? Or accurately depict herself? You know, maybe outside of school, these are all girls who would have gotten along, who might not have banded together into, like, a monstrous little clique, and, you know, and you know, in which case Samantha wouldn't have been, you know, this become felt begin to feel alienated, and, you know, begin to harbor all of this, all of these kind of darker feelings about herself, about her work, about them, about the school, about the town. You know, it's so hard to kind of gauge the kind of moral compass of any of the characters because of the setting. You know, the setting kind of warps everything, and because you know, this is an unreliable narrator.
You know, the funny thing is, it's really hard to interview you on this book, because the first half, yeah, I can interview no problem, but the second half, almost anything I ask you would be a spoiler. And the other thing is, and sometimes I think I'm a horrible interviewer because I just ask questions I'm interested in. I don't, you know, people who are listening don't know what the hell I'm talking about. And so the last thing, as we close out, is there was this last idea I had that may, and let's see if you know what it is. The last idea I had was that the something that was happening in a very small place, in a very small place. And never mind. I'll ask you. Okay, we're going to end it now. This was great.
Okay.
I love the book. And like I said, I have an independent bookstore. The book is on the front table. It's doing really well. The cover is great, which, you know,
yay.
You know, everyone says, you know, you can't judge a book by its cover, but every single person who walks into my bookstore does. Nothing I can do about it. I mean, it's just the way it is. That's why publishers do the covers instead of the author.
Yeah, it's very true.
So anyway, yeah, if you're ever in our neighborhood and feel like coming by, or this will definitely be a book club selection. So when it is, maybe I'll call you up and see if you can Skype
in
or something. I will. Okay. Well, thanks so much. I really appreciate it. And hopefully we'll talk again soon.
Oh, thank you so much. It was such a pleasure. Thank you for your wonderful questions.
So we were talking with Mona Awad about her new book, Bunny, which is sounds nice and sweet, and starts out nice and sweet, but then it gets really, really, really scary, and you get really, really confused, even at the very end. Although after the interview, she and I talked a little bit about what I thought and what she was writing, and, you know, there was something. Anyway, so I really like this. I didn't think I would because, like I told her, I'm old. And this is a book that normally you would think is for chicks. And, but no, once I got into it, which is great, I do this show because I can get into these books I otherwise wouldn't pick up. And it's been picked up, so to speak, by AMC. It's going to be a TV show. So I would read the book first, like I always suggest, and then begin to watch the TV show, which she's screenwriting, so it'll be great. Anyway, so as always, hopefully you'll join us every week. On the Avid Reader Show for discussions with, as I always say, today's most compelling authors, of which she is definitely one. So upcoming, we have Casey Sepp to discuss her fascinating book, Furious Hours, which is Murder, Fraud, and the Last Trial of Harper Lee, which I knew nothing about, but which is really, really fascinating. And then there's a whole bunch more that Rebecca scheduled, but for a complete schedule, rather than me going through them all, take a look at our website, or you can take a look at WellingtonSquareBooks.com website, or just simply go to iTunes and you'll see my gazillion different podcasts there. So as always, thanks for joining us, and we look forward to having you back here next week on The Avid Reader.